I call the House Higher Education Finance and Policy meeting to order. I'll note for the record that we do have a quorum. I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes of March the 6th.
So moved.
Oh, okay, so we have Representative Knorr got to it first. Representative Knorr moves the approval of the minutes from March 6th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Next on the agenda, we have House File 862. We have Representative Schumacher joining us. So members, I will move, since he is not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 862 be before the committee, and the motion will be to re-refer to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And Representative Schumacher, you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to speak briefly to the amendment, and we will go to the bill after that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment conforms with what the Senate language is to keep things moving appropriately and helps with the fiscal note as well.
Representative Schumacher, it certainly helps with the fiscal note. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members for hearing this bill today. This is another way that the state is working to try and combat the opioid crisis in Minnesota and an issue that's across the country. This idea came from a constituent of mine, Will Rops, and you'll find in your packet some testimony from Will. It came from a personal experience of his own where his brother ended up passing away from a fentanyl overdose and while he was in college, and he got the idea at that point that maybe we should be providing for these antagonists in college campuses. And so the original bill, as it was introduced, talked about having this on the campuses and pretty much everywhere. After reviewing it a little bit, it made more sense to have it in the dorms where this would be needed the most, and the rationale really was just why wouldn't we do this across the state? And so this is just allowing for that. Adam Thompson is also here to testify for this, and I would ask him to present.
Mr. Thompson, please come to the testifier stand and get settled in. State your name for the record, and we'll listen to your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 862. For the record, my name is Adam Thompson, and I am the Advocacy Coordinator at Students United, the statewide student association representing all current, future, and former students attending Minnesota State's 7 universities. You would normally be much luckier in hearing from some of our students, but as our student board and officers just touched down in Washington, D.C. to represent our students in meetings with Minnesota's federal delegation, I am here in their stead to share why House File 862 is so important. Every semester, Students United completes a tour of our 7 campuses where we meet with staff, faculty, administration, and most importantly, students. During this set of spring visits, we had conversations about naloxone access at every university. We also partnered with the Steve Rumler Hope Network to host trainings on administering naloxone at each campus. What we found during the visits was just a confirmation on the importance of this bill. Currently, there is a wide variance of practices when it comes to naloxone access at campuses. Many schools already go far beyond this bill, having naloxone in every AED on campus, having in every campus security bag, having a wide set of staff trained in administration and usage. But we also saw campuses that didn't have these resources, where no naloxone was available to students, little to no staff were trained on administration, or on some campuses, not even campus security had access to naloxone in the case of an emergency. We also found across the board, no matter what the school's current set of practice, that there was strong support for the policy this bill would implement. Folks we spoke with from campus housing, security, student support, presidents, and student governments all favored this policy. Students and staff on campus showed little concern about the potential costs, as this is an inexpensive policy that will be a crucial tool in saving students' lives. Many of our student senates have already passed motions of support for this bill and have also started conversations with local partners who have offered trainings and supplies. Our campuses are eager to have more done to address the opioid crisis, and fortunately, this bill is an opportunity to take an important step forward. We are grateful for Representative Schumacher's leadership on this bill, and we strongly encourage its passage. Once again, I would like to thank Chair Rarick and the members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for your testimony. Before I go to member questions, I'm just make sure that there aren't any other testifiers in the audience. Okay, seeing none, I believe Representative Hansen, you had the first hand up.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for doing this. I just signed on to the bill this morning, so I think this is a great idea. I really appreciate it. The two doses, do you guys find that that's going to be sufficient, and how do you feel about your opportunity to get refills when you need them?
Yeah, I think the two, we believe that two doses should be sufficient to have two doses in every residence hall. In the case of their usage, they would have to be, you know, resupplied. And I think we feel very confident through community partnerships or through purchasing that that would be very easily obtainable. And I think one part of this bill at putting our campuses, and I'm forgetting the exact wording, at the top of the order portal would be a helpful tool, too, to make sure campuses always have access. But we feel pretty confident that they should always be able to maintain a consistent supply.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. If there's anything we can do to help make sure you get access to that portal, should you need it, please let us know. We know that, you know, there's been rumors on some campuses that this is an addictive substance, which could not be further from the truth and is entirely fake news, and that this saves lives. So I really appreciate you doing this, and please keep up the great work. Thanks.
And Representative Hicks, was that your other hand? No? You're just pointing to Representative Hansen. Okay, fair enough. You're being a good friend. Thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Knorr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to inquire if we can add the tribal colleges to this because they're not included. I don't know if that would be a great idea to make those changes or in the next round.
So we'll go to the author, Representative Knorr, if he has any thoughts about that. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Knorr, thank you for always thinking on your feet with this. I'm open to that. I don't know if it's possible to do that amendment now. I'd be open to that now. Otherwise, it'll be in health, which I also serve on, and Representative Liebling serves on, and maybe a couple others. But we'll make sure it happens there, if not here.
Representative Knorr, we do have a 24-hour rule, and I appreciate, you know, the wide thinking and thinking about our tribal colleges. I really do appreciate that. And to that note, I think if Representative Schumacher, if you want to go through the fiscal note just real quickly, since the vast majority of the fiscal costs will be within this committee, a little bit will be in health, but do you have the fiscal note in front of you, or would you like me to hand you one?
I do have that in front of me, Madam Chair, and the overall cost for the biennium is $127,000. $10,000 of that comes from the health department, where this bill goes to next, and then $51,000 to Minnesota State and $66,000 to the University of Minnesota. Ongoing cost of about $40,000, $26,000 to Minnesota State, $14,000 to the university, but lesser because it's just continuing on for the renewals.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. And I would say the refilling of those that are expired or used is the majority of the ongoing cost. There is a little bit of training in here, too. I'm sure you've all read the fiscal note because we haven't had a lot of bills in this committee. So it's a small cost, but it is a cost to the committee. Certainly to save lives, it's probably worth it. So that's why we're hearing this bill today, and we'll be sending it to health with the yes votes of the committee. Representative Knorr, back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Schumacher, will this bill be coming to the Human Services because that's the jurisdiction of substance use disorder?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knorr, that wasn't the plan at the moment just because the funds were coming out of the Department of Health, but if we would like to have a further discussion on it in Human Services, I am open to that as well.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the reasoning behind it is because we have got the ORAC funds, the opiate funds that we have under the jurisdiction. I think sometimes we may find other ways to put in the right direction, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Knorr, I'm always listening for creative ways of fund things. So thank you, Representative Knorr. We are listening. Any other member discussion? But,
Madam Chair, that is under Chair Schumacher's jurisdiction, so maybe he can make that decision.
Thank you, Representative Noir. I appreciate that. Any other member conversation, discussions, or concerns? Okay. Seeing none, closing remarks, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, members, for your support.
With that, hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 862, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and House File 862, as amended, is referred to the House, the Committee on Health, Finance, Policy. Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. All right, members, the next bill that we have is my bill, but I'm going to be very transparent, as was Pawlowski, and this is a vehicle bill, as most of you veterans have already figured out. So I would like to move before the committee House File 2131 to be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. So I don't know if there needs to be any discussion on this, but I will open it up for discussion. Okay, seeing none, again, this is a vehicle bill, and I have spoken with our lead, Wolgamont, and a few other members on the Democrat side. So if there's no more member discussion, then I will renew my motion that House File 2131 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. House File 2131 is referred to the General Register. Okay, now for the fun stuff for the day. We have Minn State, please come to the table. And they have been preparing for quite some time, members. So they have a lot of information that's in your packets. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and continue with your slide presentation.
Sure. My name is George Soll. I'm the board chair of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It's always fun to be referred to as the fun stuff. But thank you, Chair Rarick, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present today on behalf of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. My name is George Soll, and I have the privilege to serve as chair of the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State. Like many of you, I am a product of our system. I started my journey at Minnesota State over 50 years ago, yikes, as a first-generation college student at then Morehead State University. As you know, Chancellor Scott Olson could not be here today, and he sends his regrets. I'd like to provide the committee with an overview of our presentation today. It's up on the screen. We have several Minnesota State leaders who will address the various riders in our budget. Kim Lynch and Paul Shepard will speak to student-related budget riders. Jesse Mason and Phil Ariano will speak to workforce budget riders. And following them, Vice Chancellor Bill Mackey and Steve Ernest will address the remaining riders in our budget. But I'd first like to provide a brief overview of Minnesota State. Our system consists of 26 community and technical colleges from one end of the state to the other, and seven state universities, and we're governed by a 15-member board of trustees appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. There's one trustee from each of the eight congressional districts, and there are four at-large seats as well as three student trustees. I welcome my fellow trustee, Tim Hipsch, who's attending today's hearing. The Board of Trustees has policy and oversight responsibility for system planning, academic programs, fiscal management, personnel, admission requirements, and setting tuition and fees. We wisely leave the operation of Minnesota State to Chancellor Olson, his cabinet and system staff, and to the colleges and universities. As I travel to campuses around the state, I'm impressed by the partnerships around our colleges and universities. Our schools are important parts of their communities, and those communities, their employers, nonprofits, are important supporters of the colleges and universities. And you, legislators in the state of Minnesota, are also important partners with Minnesota State, and we appreciate you. There's a number that I often identify when I talk about Minnesota State, and I'm continuously amazed by it, and that is that we educate 270,000 students per year. That is a very large number, and if you think about all of the people connected with those students, family, friends, et cetera, employers, coworkers, that's a large number of people in the state of Minnesota affected by Minnesota State. 69% of those students attend colleges and universities outside the Twin Cities. More than 63,000 are students of color and indigenous students. More than 58,000 are 25 years or older. More than 53,000 are low-income Pell-eligible students. More than 38,000 are the first in their family to attend college. And 6,500 are veterans and service members. Our colleges and universities serve students no matter where they are on their educational journey, from a certificate all the way to an applied doctoral program. High school students, recent graduates of high school, students returning to complete a degree or start another, and adults already in the workforce who need or want additional education or training. We offer more than 4,000 academic programs, and students can take many of those online. As you know, a big part of our mission is workforce development. We form partnerships with employers across the state to ensure graduates entering the workforce are ready to contribute the first day on the job. We offer approximately 9,600 customized training, specialty, and professional classes. This is a fluid process as our campuses strive to meet employers' needs. The next slide represents the impact of our colleges and universities in terms of workforce development. I like to say that our colleges and universities provide education and training to the people who get the work done in Minnesota. You can see the numbers. We educate high percentages of peace officers, mechanics, nurses, teachers, and more. And 86% of those graduates find jobs in their field or a related field of study. Minnesota State is the economic imperative for the state of Minnesota. We've heard a clear message from employer and community leaders across the state that they need more graduates with the skill set to move our economy forward. We understand the importance of this work, and the board, the chancellor, and campus leaders are focused on this work. And unless you have any questions, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Associate Vice Chancellors Kim Lynch and Paul Shepard to speak to the students, to the system's student support efforts and budget riders in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Sewell. Are there any member questions? Okay, we'll continue with the presentation.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with the slide presentation.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kim Lynch. I currently serve as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Educational Development and Technology. The first rider we'll talk about today is funding for the Z Degree Textbook Program. The rider can be found on line 140 on the Chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. In fiscal year 2024 and 2025, we received $1,050,000 to expand free offerings in course materials and resources. The base for this appropriation for fiscal year 2026 and later is $50,000. Thank you for your past support of our work to make textbooks free for students at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and therefore reduce the out-of-pocket costs for our students. You have been really exceptional partners in this work. The slide here.
One second, sorry. We have Representative Wilgemont has a comment or a question.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for being here in front of our Higher Education Committee to give us this information. Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment how proud I am of the success of the Z Degree textbook program. I originally authored the bill in 2019. It was one of the first things that I ever worked on as a legislator on the Higher Education Committee. And I started working on that after hearing from so many students. I couldn't believe this. There are students who go through the entire semester without a textbook because they can't afford it. Mm-hmm. That's not right, Madam Chair. And so we put this forward, and you have just taken the opportunity and done so much good with it. I've heard great successes both in my district, in St. Cloud, and throughout the state. And, of course, the numbers speak for themselves. So, again, just thank you for your diligent administration of the Z Degree textbook program. And we look forward to supporting its continued success. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Wolgamont. I thought you might say something there. Well deserved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Yes, you have been a great partner, and I am so proud to say, because you have asked me every time I've been up here previously, is St. Cloud engaged in this? And I'm so pleased to say they are, both the university and the technical and community college are well on their way to implementing a zero textbook cost degree. So that's really, really good news. I'm glad I can say that after all your support, that we're getting there for your community as well. So thank you. So I just wanted to really run through a few of the numbers because they really are exciting. We have shown for academic year 2024, $3.1 million that we've been able to identify in savings for an aggregate of over $12.6 million. Really exciting. Additionally, we have 10 colleges now offering those Z degrees, which is a pathway. For those of you who are unfamiliar with that term, it's really a pathway to either an associate's degree or most recently a bachelor's degree with zero cost for textbooks. We have 12 colleges and universities that are on track to implement Z degree, or they're exploring their potential to do so. And we have additional colleges and universities that offer these zero cost courses and have implemented a course search so that students can actually find them and take them. The numbers again, 6,200 course sections that we've been unable to track. I'm going to just even say that's undercounting because we're only drawing from where people have entered that information into our system. Over 126,000 students enrolled that we've been able to track in those zero cost courses, and really proud that every single one of our colleges and universities have faculty on their campuses that have participated in using free open educational resources. So really exciting just to see the growth of this. I'll mention one number that's not on the slide, and that's the return on investment, or ROI. Always like a really important thing to mention. Students have saved between $7 and $10 for every $1 invested in this work. The lower number is really taking into account all of the various sources of investment, and the higher number, the $10 for everyone, is really just based on what you as a legislature have put toward that work. So again, really proud to be able to say that this is something that is paying back. But you know what's even more than that? This work goes beyond affordability. When students have their course materials and their textbooks on that very first day of class, they don't have to decide between buying that textbook or going without. So one of our colleges has already, and we're trying to expand this work, data from one of our colleges shows that students in Z degree courses are more successful than those in comparable sections. They did a randomized study and really showed that this makes a difference, not just to affordability, but to actual course success than sections that were using the publisher texts. This is a student success initiative that benefits all students, and with those in greatest financial need, as you can see by the numbers there, really accessing a little bit more. Otherwise, it's really being pretty much equally accessed by all our students, but those in need financially are doing so just a little bit more, and that's really good news. So what would we do then with $1 million each year in base funding if we were to get that? The first thing we would do is to expand the number of and the support for campuses exploring, implementing, and sustaining Z degrees. The good news is campus interest in this work continues to grow. So we would continue supporting faculty to help them adapt, and create those free open educational resources. We would support additional colleges and universities who want to implement those. And we would add courses to existing Z degrees to offer more options for students and to balance attrition from faculty either retiring or programmatic shifts, so that we have this way to sustain the work even as they meet that marker. If you don't have a way to sustain it, sometimes those great initiatives can fall apart. We don't want that to happen. The second thing is we would continue developing zero-cost transfer pathways for a system-wide impact. Work on zero textbook courses for the business transfer pathway is in the planning and faculty recruitment phase, with work to launch this coming fall 2025. faculty collaborating across a field of study, especially in a highly enrolled field like business, offer the potential to really greatly increase that zero textbook cost courses across our entire system. And that also helps support our students who transfer from college to university, as well as our mobile students who are just moving among colleges and universities. So this would really be the next big undertaking of our work that we have not yet. We've just started the preliminary stages of doing both through transfer pathway and through expanded zero course offerings at our colleges and universities. So that's thing number two. Thing number three, provide instructional design and technology support for developing highest quality teaching and learning materials that are free for students. We had work funded by a federal grant that we received a few years back, and one of the things we learned from that is that faculty really benefited from instructional design and technology support when they were looking to create or adapt highly engaging, interactive, and digitally accessible materials. So really emphasizing how we can be very assistive in the quality of these products. So we would apply resources to that work as well. And then the last thing that we would do, additional access to paid library resources that are free to students. Not all materials are or can be available as open educational resources. So we've been working with our libraries to cover the cost of, our first effort is to cover the cost of an e-platform that shares over 300,000 electronic materials, and to make select purchases where open educational resources just aren't possible. And I'll give you a quick example. I often use literature in that space, partly because that's my background. The Catcher in the Rye or the Bluest Eye, like if I want to use that, that's just not an open educational resource. So I have to have other means to make a literature course actually a zero-cost course. So that's where we've used our library resourcing to say we can fill in some gaps to really make this a comprehensive approach that's really critical to get that to happen. And that partnership with libraries has been really valuable. So that's what I have to share today. Thank you for letting me share what you've helped do to make this happen. We've been very grateful for previous investment and for your consideration of, if nothing else, support for the work, like go you, even if there isn't financial support. So thank you so much.
Sure. Chair Rarick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Shepard, and I have the honor to serve as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs and Enrollment Management for Minnesota State. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak about the rider focused on student support, and that rider can be found on line 143 on the Chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. The investment made by the legislature to support comprehensive student support has enabled Minnesota State to implement innovative system-wide strategies that have already yielded positive results. Campus leaders, as well as our own research on the experiences of our students, has revealed challenges students face related to basic needs and security, such as lack of access to consistent food, housing, transportation, and other critical needs, as well as mental health, are interfering with students' ability to enroll in higher education and continue their education until graduation. Minnesota State participated in the nation's largest survey focused on understanding the prevalence of basic needs and security, and learned that among our student participants, 37% experienced food insecurity within the previous month of taking that survey. 48% experienced housing insecurity within the previous year of taking that survey, and 18% experienced homelessness within the previous year. The survey results also revealed mental health concerns as a frequently cited experience among our students that prompted questions about whether they could continue on their education journey. With this legislative support, in August of 2022, Minnesota State launched a centralized basic needs resource hub accessible to all students at all colleges and universities 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, where students could call or text to receive basic needs resources available at their college or university and in their community. This idea was generated by students and was a first of its kind partnership between higher education and community organizations. Since its launch, the Basic Needs Resource Hub has served over 2,400 students, and 97% of those students reported a positive experience, and the resource has often been referred to by students as a blessing and something that provided timely support they needed. Another strategy we were able to pursue because of this investment is significantly increasing access to mental health support. Minnesota State launched a partnership with Mantra Health in September of 2024. Mantra Health was selected as a result of a comprehensive RFP process that involved an 18-person faculty and staff RFP committee with representation from across our system. Mantra Health is designed to provide supplemental mental health support that works hand-in-hand with campus-based staff and faculty. Mantra Health is accessible via a website and an app students can download on their phone. Students log in with their college or university email and password and access a range of support resources. Those resources include self-care, including self-paced short courses and modules on a range of mental health-focused topics, clinically monitored peer-to-peer support functionality, on-demand mental health care during hours that are often difficult to staff on campus, 12 telecounseling sessions with a clinician in Mantra's National Clinical Provider Network, and 24/7 mental health crisis support. Currently, over 1,600 students are receiving support through Mantra, and our goal is to continue to increase that number in the spring 2025 semester and beyond. Mantra provides functionality that campus-based staff and faculty have shared as needed to expand access and support they are already providing. We are thrilled students are responding well to Mantra, and we are looking forward to building on this partnership as we move into the future. The final major student service initiative we were able to launch because of the legislative support provided is our emergency grant program. Last week marked the one-year anniversary of our program, and in that time, over 4,800 students have received an emergency grant to help address an unexpected financial emergency. Since the launch of the program, we have disbursed over $3 million to students across our system. The average grant amount a student receives is just under $700. And our data shows most students are seeking emergency financial support to address unexpected costs associated with housing, food, transportation, and childcare. To receive an emergency grant, students complete an application through a form available online or via an app, and those applications are reviewed by campus-based staff. Once the application is approved by the campus team, students are prompted through the website or app to claim their grant through a number of convenient options such as direct deposit or payment to a vendor directly. Data from the program show that 38% of students in our system who have received an emergency grant reported experiencing homelessness during their time as a student. 31% of students receiving an emergency grant shared that they are responsible for at least one minor child. The emergency grant program provides timely support to students when they need it so they can remain enrolled until they complete their education. Our experience since the launch of the program has demonstrated the need for additional resources to support our students. Without this program, an unexpected emergency like a flat tire or necessary car repair could result in students departing their college or university journey in order to put limited resources towards their vehicle. This program has demonstrated that timely financial support can make a significant difference in keeping students on a path to a degree. Minnesota State is incredibly grateful for the legislative investment in the last session that has made these unique, and innovative student support strategies possible. The funding provided has enabled Minnesota State to not only create these comprehensive programs that are available to all students at all colleges and universities, but sustain them well into the future. The next rider is the funding to support the sexual assault reporting statute.
Before you move on, I have two questions for members. First, Representative Hansen, and then Robbins.
Thank you, Chair. And I have a question about the last two slides, the rider for student support and then the basic needs mental health and other high needs student supports. On campus, who's helping connect students to those sorts of resources?
Vice Chancellor Rick Shepherd.
Chair Rarick and Representative Hansen, that does vary based on colleges and universities. We have asked each college and university to identify who their main contact staff are at each college and university so at the system level we can communicate with them consistently to provide updates and also hear about their experiences on campus.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. I want to highlight this because this is a conversation that's been happening with college counselors. We do want to make sure that college counselors are present on every single campus across the state within the system and all of the other ones. So I would be interested in hearing if there are additional resources that the system needs in order to make sure that we have enough college counselors on campus to help connect folks to these. I know a lot of times it ends up being like financial aid or admissions or some other folks that kind of overlap, but we know that college counselors are uniquely qualified and trained in order to provide this. So just want to respect that profession, and if there's anything we can do to help make sure you can continue to offer that, I would be willing to bet that adding more college counselors might be helpful, and I'd love to see how we can help. Thanks.
Great. Over to Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I just wanted to follow up on the MANTRA Mental Health Supports platform. Could you give us more information about how it works? Are the students connecting, like, via a telehealth appointment with a licensed counselor, or is it a AI chatbot, or I don't know. I'd like to understand how it works, and I'd also like to know, like, what happens to the student's data? Are they tracking data about the student, and then how is that protected?
Vice Chancellor Shepherd.
Yeah, Chair Rarick and Representative Robbins. Yes, with Mantra Health, students access it via their website or an app that they can download on their phone. Telecounseling is one component of the Mantra Health kind of profile of services that students can access. Many students do use the telecounseling functionality, but there are others as well, such as self-paced courses, peer support functionality in crisis response. I think additionally, in terms of your question focused on data, there is general data that is collected by Mantra as students use it. It is not necessarily student identifying data. If students who access Mantra would like someone from our colleges or universities, such as a counselor, to follow up with them, they are able to let someone within the Mantra environment know that, and then that information would be passed on to the campus counselor to follow up with that student. But that is at the student's discretion, and that would be at the student's prompting.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. So is any of the peer counseling or counseling done by AI?
Vice Chancellor Shepherd.
Chair Rarick and Representative Robbins, no, it is not. It is an environment where peers can connect with one another. It is clinically monitored so that if there is a discussion between peers that would elevate to needing some sort of clinical intervention, that can be prompted. So a clinician can come into that chat and help provide additional support, but that is not AI generated or administered by AI.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Last question. And then this Mantra platform, do they store or sell the student data?
Vice Chancellor.
Chair Rarick and Representative Robbins, no, they do not.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a lot of the same kinds of questions as Representative Robbins. I was going to ask about the data privacy and some of what you mentioned. I appreciate the answers to her questions. I really had the same questions because we're seeing this a lot, that some of these hubs are not necessarily protecting data under the Minnesota Health Records Act, for example, because they're just connectors. And so they're not covered by our laws. And I appreciate your assurance on that. I guess I'm not familiar with this particular one, but I'm wondering kind of the same question about the whole centralized basic needs resource hub. I mean, let me just say, I think it's very impressive what you've done to support students, and I can only imagine that's probably helping a lot of students stay in school who wouldn't be able to otherwise. So I think that's a great, great effort. But I am concerned that, when students are using some kind of a hub or especially online, that we're protecting their data and that, you know, they aren't required to give away their data in order to get the help they need. So, yeah, I don't know if you have any more to say about that issue.
Vice Chancellor.
Chair Rarick and Representative, I think I would just add that that was top of mind for us as we engaged in the RFP process looking for supplemental support. So the team of experts that reviewed that RFP felt comfortable with what Mantra was providing. And that was also something reviewed by our general counsel as well.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have more, Vice Chancellor?
I do. Just briefly, one additional rider focused on sexual assault reporting statute. And that rider can be found on line 138 of the Chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. And before I begin, Chair Rarick, we'd like to thank you for your work in this area when the legislation was drafted several years ago. The funding is utilized to secure critical technology infrastructure that is necessary for the reporting in compliance with statutory requirements. The technology also provides case management functionality for the system office to manage investigations. The funding is also used to support sexual violence prevention efforts on the campus level, including training and educational programs that are offered at multiple colleges and universities. Support for system-level convenings and professional development opportunities for campus Title IX coordinators and other staff working directly in this area are also included in this funding. Minnesota Statute 135A.15 requires new students to receive sexual violence prevention training within the first 10 days after the start of the student's first semester of classes. The funding provided here does not cover the cost associated with providing this training to students at our colleges and universities. The cost associated with this training is covered by each college and university. So, Madam Chair, with that, that was the end of the riders that we were slated to discuss, and with your permission, would love to pass this along to our colleagues.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your presentations. Any other final questions before we move to the next section? Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed here that for emergency grants that were allocated, $2.5 million were allocated throughout the system, and you had about 3,600 students. How does one go about attaining these emergency grants? Is it like an application process? Can you kind of give me some more details? I would love to know.
Vice Chancellor.
Absolutely. Chair Rarick, Representative Schwartz. The process varies a bit by campus, but what is standard is that each college and university has an application that's available on a website or an application app that they can download on their phone. Students fill out brief information about their need and who they are, and then that application is forwarded to a campus group that reviews those applications. And once those are reviewed and approved, perhaps some are denied if it doesn't fall within the scope of acceptable funding, then through that same website or app, a student is prompted with that decision and then is invited, if that application is approved, to claim their funds either through direct deposit or paying a vendor directly. So it is all accessible through a website at each college or university.
Representative Schwartz.
So you said that the funds would be directed, like direct deposit, is that correct, my understanding? And what happens if the student decided to pocket the cash and they come back again for the exact same situation that they were in prior to? How do you guys, I guess, monitor that?
Vice Chancellor?
Sure. Chair Rarick and Representative Schwartz, there is extensive record keeping within the technology that we use to administer the application program. So campus reviewers would know how many times a student has gone back to request an emergency grant and would review that application. So direct deposit is one option that students can use to utilize the funds, but there are others as well. But I would say that the safeguard to the scenario that you laid out would probably rest in the hands of that record keeping and also that comprehensive review by the campus staff.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you.
Vice Chancellor, since she asked, is there a limit? So 2, 3, 10, is there a limit on how many times they can ask for an emergency grant in a year or 2 years? Or Vice Chancellor?
Yes, Chair Rarick, that number varies by campus. We've invited each campus to determine what conditions they might want to put on their iteration of the program. With limited funds, I think campuses are very judicious about how those are appropriated. So there isn't one comprehensive answer to that, but we've certainly recommended that our colleges and universities consider that as they launch their program.
Very good, thank you. Well, we'll move on unless there's any other member questions. Representative Allen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question. You kind of sparked my interest. Do you you say you pay vendors directly. Do you guys actually ask for receipts as far as your, as far as when students blew a tire, whatever it is? Do you actually ask for a receipt to be able to prove that that's, you know, where the money ended up going? Because I know you're paying vendors direct, but when they're direct, you're direct depositing into the student's bank account, do you still ask for a receipt ultimately in the end?
Vice Chancellor.
Yeah, Chair Rarick and Representative Allen, that's a great question. Yes, we do provide an opportunity for students to upload documentation within that application and ask them to do so.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, we'll move on to workforce. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Our workforce development team is up to bat. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with the slide presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jesse Mason. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. Today I'm going to speak about two of the riders in our budget. But before I do, I'd like to say a few words about the investments that you've made in workforce development. We are grateful for the workforce development investments you made last biennium. You appropriated $13.5 million in one-time funding for equipment and learning environments, along with an additional $13.5 million to develop and expand industry sector programming. This funding will benefit our future workers and all of our companies and communities we serve throughout Minnesota. Our colleges and university leaders have been committed to raising the match funds provided for each of the fiscal year 2025. The slide that you are viewing are those campus leaders who are committed to raising those funds by signing a pledge last year. I'd like to start with the first budget rider that develops and expands industry sector programming. The rider can be found in line 46 in Chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. Next slide. The legislature provided the $13.5 million in one-time funding for programming. In the first year, we gave each campus $201,500 equally to expand on their work and to make up statewide impact with the funding. In FY 2025, each institution received $120,000 in an RFP process, which required match funding, that they would work with companies and community organizations to match the funding that they requested to expand industry sector and work-based learning. To date, of the $6.75 million in 2025 funds, with that match requirements, we have been able to generate over $9 million in planned and received matched investment between the colleges and university and the companies and the community organizations that they've been working with. We have two examples, and I have more if you want. Colleges and universities have been doing a great job in expanding their industry partnership and work-based learning. But one of our largest, and this slide kind of highlights that, are expanding dental assistance and dental hygiene programs. Four colleges are adding or expanding dental assistance and dental hygiene program to serve communities across Minnesota. And those colleges include places like Rochester Community and Technical College, Central Lakes College, Central Century College, and Anoka Ramsey College, Cambridge campus. Each program is leveraging donations from local employers as well as Delta Dental to acquire and install state-of-the-art equipment such as dental chairs that can cost more than $45,000 each. These investments ensure that students receive not only their credentials but practical skills needed to begin to serve effectively from day one. The second example is Metro State University. Work-based learning has developed an apprentice-type program that combines work-based learning across five program areas that currently have 20 students earning credits and income. Industry partners like KPMG for accounting students, Securian for our cybersecurity and data science students, Frazier and Touchstone for mental health practitioner student, and the list goes on and on with some of the work that we've been able to do because of the investment that you have made for industry sector and work-based learning funding. So as you can see in this slide, the funds are distributed across 13 different sectors with transportation, healthcare, information technology, construction, and manufacturing and energy technology being the most served industries through this investment. The second rider I would like to talk about is the Transfer Pathway Child Development Associates. As you can see, this was a one-time funding of $475,000 the legislator appropriated in fiscal year 2024. This rider can be found on line 151 and chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. To date, we have created a CDA pathway to college work team and leadership advisory that have done their due diligence and their work with representatives from faculty from across our colleges and universities in establishing how we would create that pathways from those real world experience to turning the college credits toward a degree. So far, we've agreed upon two courses for 6 credits for CDA holders that involve child safety, health and nutrition, and growth and child growth and development. Furthermore, as we continue to progress our efforts in identifying how do we market it to students, how do we get them in the pathway, and how do we help them meet that credential area so that they can make a living wage doing the work that they love to do. Even though we have much more work to do, I'm sure that we'll be able to support great progress, especially what we have already established through our Credit for Prior Learning network in the state of Minnesota. If there's no questions, I will turn it over to my colleague.
Any member questions at this spot? Not seeing any, so please introduce yourself to the committee and continue with the slide presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Rarick, members of the committee. My name is Phil Ariano, and I serve as the Associate Director for Workforce and Economic Development. I'd like to start with the Workforce Development Scholarship Rider. This rider can be found on line 136 on the Chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. These scholarships play a crucial role in supporting students pursuing high-demand careers across Minnesota, helping to address workforce shortages and align education and industry needs. I'd like to highlight the impact of the Workforce Development Scholarship Program, which continues to provide critical financial support for students pursuing careers in high-demand industries across Minnesota. In fiscal year 24, over 2,000 scholarships were awarded, demonstrating strong student demand and utilization. Of those, over 1,960 scholarships supported two-year college students, reinforcing the program's role in making education accessible for individuals entering career pathways that are vital to Minnesota's economy. The scholarship program is strategically aligned with workforce needs, supporting industries experiencing shortages. 42% of scholarships were awarded to students entering healthcare services, addressing Minnesota's ongoing demand for healthcare professionals. 13% of awards supported careers in transportation, ensuring the state has the workforce needed for logistics, supply chain, and infrastructure development. 12% of awards went toward advanced manufacturing, supporting Minnesota's role as a leader in high-tech and precision manufacturing. Other key sectors benefiting from the program include IT, public safety, and education, to name a few. These scholarships reduce financial barriers, allowing more students to complete their education and enter the workforce quickly. The program is directly tied to economic growth, helping Minnesota businesses fill essential jobs with skilled workers. From fiscal year 22 and 23, over 1,800 graduates earned academic awards, demonstrating that scholarship recipients are completing their programs at high rates. More importantly, 80% of graduates secured employment within 12 months of completing their programs, showing a direct return on investment for both students and Minnesota's workforce. These numbers prove the program is working. Students are not only getting financial support, but completing their education and finding jobs quickly. Now, I've shared some of the numbers, outcomes, and the workforce impact on these scholarships, but I want to take a moment to highlight what this program truly means to students. You will see a photo of scholarship recipients from Century College. Each of them awarded a workforce development scholarship to help them pursue their education and careers. You can see the pride and excitement on their faces, because for them, this isn't just a scholarship, it's a life-changing opportunity. For many of these students, this support means the difference between starting a program or delaying their education. Being able to focus on learning instead of financial stress, a direct path into high-demand careers where they can contribute to Minnesota's economy and support their families. I have received many letters from recipients who wanted to express their deep gratitude for this program. Here are a couple key messages. Ava, a radiologic technologist, student's story is one of resilience and determination. In 2022, she experienced a major medical complication from her pregnancy while attending a university 2.5 hours from home. She had to completely change her life plans, moving back home and becoming a full-time mother. Determined to still pursue a career, she found Century College's radiologic technology program, but struggled with finances while providing for her newborn. Now, I could focus more on my kiddo, my family, and my academics, rather than using every free moment to be at work, she shared. And Gregory, he's a passionate nursing student working night shifts in the emergency department at North Memorial. The Workforce Development Scholarship allowed him to reduce his work hours, giving him more time to study, more rest before clinicals, and more time with family, a balance that has been critical for his success. Thanks to this scholarship, I was able to cut my work hours down, which has been huge. It's meant I can actually focus on learning instead of just surviving, said Gregory. He sees firsthand the critical need for more healthcare providers and emphasizes that this scholarship isn't just about helping students, it's helping Minnesota's healthcare system fill essential roles. These are just two of many stories that highlight what this program means. It's not just a financial boost, it's changing lives, ensuring students succeed, and strengthening our workforce. I'd like to pause here, Madam Chair and representatives, to address any questions about the Workforce Development Scholarship, or with your permission, I'd like to move to the next rider.
Any member questions about Workforce Development Scholarships? Yes, of course, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the presentation that both of you have given. So when I was looking at page, let me go back to it. It would be on slide 22. So my question is, as I'm looking at these scholarship grants, and I just took the 1962 and divided it by the 4.5 million, simple math. It's $2,200 per grant, unless I've made a mathematical error someplace. Can you tell me what is the average grant that people receive for these?
Associate Director.
Madam Chair, representatives, very close on the math. Okay. The grant is $2,500 per year for students. The students are eligible for 1 and 2 years at the community college and one more at the university to promote transferability.
Oh, awesome. Okay, thank you so much.
Any other member questions? Okay, seeing none, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move to the Equipment and Learning Environment Rider. This rider can be found on line 145 on the Chapter 41 spreadsheet in your packet. Over $6 million in funds were allocated each year of the biennium. These funds were used to assist our colleges and universities with making critical upgrades to equipment and learning environments, ensuring our students receive hands-on, industry-relevant training that prepares them for high-demand careers. Across our colleges and universities, we've seen incredible collaborations that provide cutting-edge equipment and real-world learning opportunities. I would like to share two great examples of how these partnerships are making an impact. M State has partnered with key organizations like Sanford Health and Veden Trust to match funding for critical upgrades across its healthcare and STEM programs. Major facility and equipment upgrades include echocardiography equipment, innovative health simulation lab equipment, and major renovations to their health simulation lab, empowering our students with real-life skills needed in clinical settings. Leveraging the equipment and learning environment funds along with match funding, Minnesota West has completed upgrades across several programs, as well as including upgrades for their auto mechanic program, carpentry, power line, and welding. These targeted investments ensure that students across a wide range of programs at Minnesota West have access to the tools, technologies, and resources necessary to succeed in their fields. This continued support for these initiatives will allow us to expand opportunities, strengthen industry partnerships, and equip more students for success in high-demand careers. These funds are not just about upgrading classrooms, they're about empowering students, strengthening Minnesota's workforce, and driving economic growth. Thank you for your time and for your commitment to investing in the future of our students and our state, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Any member questions or comments at this point? Okay, seeing none, thank you. We'll move on. Welcome back, Vice Chancellor Mackey. Go ahead and state your name for the record and continue with the slide presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Mackey. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Facilities for Minnesota State. And I would like to start by just walking through some basic financial information before jumping into the riders that we haven't covered to this point. You heard about some of the riders from Session Law 2023 Chapter 41 from my colleagues that are responsible for student support and workforce development. My colleague Steve Ernest in financial planning and analysis are going to go through the remaining riders from Chapter 41, which you can see on the slide in front of you. Before we do that, I would like to provide a brief overview of the system's FY24 overall financial picture by sharing at a high level the results of our audited financial statements along with the system's revenue sources and how the system allocates and spends our resources. At our November 2024 board meeting, our external auditors present the results of our previous fiscal year's audited financial statements. And for Minnesota State, for over the past 20 years, we've received an unmodified opinion, which is essentially a clean audit from our external auditors. We have some good news to report related to our overall financial condition as a system, and a large part of that, those results have to do with a significant increase in the state investment in Minnesota State and higher education that occurred this biennium. Our overall financial position improved from 2.3 to 3.6 with a measure we call the CFI. It's a higher ed number where they take our financial statements, our balance sheet, our income statement, our statement of cash flows, and they it gets boiled down to essentially one number that's a standard number used by our Higher Learning Commission, or our accrediting body, as well as the U.S. Department of Education. And a number that is closer to zero indicates not a strong financial health or financial distress. Numbers that are in the three range generally consider pretty solid financial picture to numbers that increase to five, six, and seven indicate even stronger financial health. So you can see that our financial health improved considerably from fiscal year 23 and 24. And the two main drivers behind that was the increase in the state investment or state appropriation increased by $167 million, which was a 21% increase, And the first time since fiscal year 2011, we did see an increase in our enrollment as a system of 2.5%. And I think you've heard in previous testimony or will hear that our enrollment for this year, 24-25, is up in excess of 6%. And a large part of it is due to the investments that have been made not only in Minnesota State, but also into the financial aid programs like the North Star Promise and other financial aid programs through the Office of Higher Education. The revenue for Minnesota State, for our colleges and universities, our two main revenue sources are the funding from the state, which is our state appropriations, which is the purple part of this pie chart on the bottom, which made up 42% in fiscal year 24, and then the tuition and the fees that our students are assessed, which made up about 30% of our overall funds, or just over $674 million for fiscal year 24. I mentioned the change in the state appropriation. We did see an increase in our tuition revenue, and tuition is frozen for this biennium. However, the increases that we had in enrollment did drive additional tuition and fee revenue. You'll also notice that our grants make up about 20% of our overall revenue. The majority of that is financial aid. And from federal, state, and private grants. And that amount is settling back down to a lower percentage. We had a significant amount of higher education emergency relief funding that came to us during the pandemic between fiscal years 20, and the remainder of it was still being spent in fiscal year 24. But just wanted to give the committee an idea of how reliant Minnesota State Colleges universities are on state appropriation, state support, and the tuition revenue and the fee revenue that it receives from its students. We take two different methods that we look at when we look at our expenditure data as a system, and this one is characterized by natural classification. And so being in higher education, you'll see the largest component of our operating expenses are salaries and benefits, making up close to $1.5 billion in fiscal 24. Or just about 70% of our budget. When we look at this only on a general fund basis, which is our state appropriation and where our tuition lies, basically the main operating budget for our colleges and universities, the amount of compensation in those budgets usually ranges around 75%. Other expenses that you'll note is that purchase services is about 12%, supplies 5%, but generally speaking, compensation is our main expense driver.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, can you let the committee know how many of the contracts that you directly, that Minn State directly negotiates, and how many are negotiated with the governor's administration and MMB?
Madam Chair, yes. So, Minnesota State negotiates its own contracts with its faculty units, which would be the two-year faculty, MSCF, the four-year teaching faculty, the IFO, and the four-year administrative and surface faculty known as MUSAF. And also Minnesota State has its own administrator's plan. We utilize the state's contract for much of our staff units, so that the two largest ones are AFSCME and MAPE that are negotiated through MMB, and then we also have commissioner's plan and managerial plan are probably our next two largest. So we typically how it works related to Minnesota State's timeline related to labor negotiations as well as setting its budget is usually the state settles agreements first with AFSCME and MAPE, and then depending on the year, sometime in the coming months after that, we begin settling our contracts with our faculty units.
Right, so it's a pattern bargaining, and we don't have really much activity anymore in the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, but I spent over a decade on that committee, that's where we do a deep dive. And so the difference I would say that's important at this juncture is that the last settlement sheet I just looked at, and I still have it up on my computer, was the settlement was for the fiscal year starting in July 1 of 23, there was a 5.5% increase in salaries for all of the state employees, except for the four contracts that they negotiate. And then the next year after that was a 5.4% across the board increase. That doesn't include all the other things that were added, but just high level. So that would have been AFSCME, MAPE, and any other state employee contracts that you utilize. Conversely, when I looked at the settlement sheet for what you were able to negotiate, I believe it was a 2.5 and a 2.5 during those same years. We always have a concern that you have control over some but not all of your employees, and some of them are negotiated outside of your power and authority. And I just want to point out that in this case, it was significantly different. So, yeah, Representative Cleburne.
Well, wouldn't that kind of rely on what funding we would give the institutions? I mean, they don't have a way to produce revenue, right? So if they put in a budget request and they wanted to pay more than 2.5%, we would have to increase the allocation, correct?
Representative Cleburne, it's not exactly like that. They have to figure it out. So I guess what I'm trying to point out is for their AFSCME and MAPE employees that they have, the state of Minnesota, so MMB negotiates those state employee contracts, and we do pattern bargaining. Mm-hmm. So those two contracts are typically settled first. All the years I've been here, they were settled first. And in starting July 1 of 23, it was 5.5% across the board. And the next year, it was 4.5% across the board. So they bear that. They have to pay that. They don't have an option. And so whether we fund them or not, you know, that it's kind of like two separate questions.
No,
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. I do understand what you're saying about that, how the negotiation goes. But if we are seeing earlier that 5.5 is going to AFSCME and MAPE, right, because they don't get to negotiate those, then if we wanted parity for the other three, four unions that you talked about, is that correct? Four, you have the Minnesota State College Faculty, IFO, MESAF, you said, and the administrators, is that correct? We would need to come up with extra money for you to match that, is that correct?
Vice Chancellor Mackey, do you want to answer that? it's very confusing, and the contracts are negotiated kind of at an odd time when we're doing budget, and so it gets to be confusing, but Vice Chancellor.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, there are a lot of complex variables that go into it. So the contracts that were settled for the 24-25 biennium, there was an across-the-board component as well as a progression step component. So the per-year settlements were in the five range when you take progression steps and across the board increases. I mentioned we have two main sources of revenue. One is from the state and one is with tuition revenue. And so those are the two main factors when we look at fully funding a settlement. Generally speaking, we are at times not fully funding a settlement because there's other factors that go into it. There's the competitiveness that our colleges and universities have to have with recruiting faculty. There's, very minimal increases that happen during a time period during the pandemic. I'm not a labor negotiations person by any means, but the calculus in coming up with what a appropriate settlement is more than just the available revenue in order to get it done and be able to move forward as colleges and universities.
Just one last. Yes, of course, Representative Cleburne.
I understand the complexity of the situation. It is multifaceted. But my concern in the negotiations is that the union that gets negotiated with last is the one that often has the least power to have their requests fulfilled, right? So when we are looking at these contract negotiations, are they all done at the same time? Are they done at separate times? How is that done?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleavorn, the faculty contract negotiations are typically all happening simultaneously. Now, the settlements and when they come in, that can vary by weeks or months depending on the bargaining unit. I would say if we look at the data, the settlements for the faculty units are similar, whether it's the one that settles first or the one that settles last. So it varies slightly, but generally speaking, that's how the process tends to play out. And those settlements can be anywhere from happening in the summer to well into fall semester, and even some years going further than that. Because there's also other issues that are being bargained besides salary and wages and benefits. It can be language items and various other things.
Thank you very much.
Representative Cleavorn, and I know you're on the State Government Committee, so as lead, correct? And so you have seen contracts. And I guess I would just say that the Subcommittee on Employee Relations hasn't met since, I think it was December of 23, where we get to talk about all these things at great length. It's a bicameral subcommittee, a very important one, and I'd like to see it come back and be more thoughtful over some of these things. So I'm going to ask you one other quick question, and then we'll let you move on. But so we are coming back into the season, I believe, of negotiations, and I haven't seen any settlements in the last few months, but we will be seeing some settlements. And typically, again, when AFSCME and MAPE, when they settle, that's a pattern, and then all the state employee contracts are very, very similar with some variation. Yours are different than the state employee contracts, and you do have things outside of that, like maybe if a spouse wants to go to get some academic credits, they can, you know, some of it might be paid for, or different things like that. But when do you start your negotiations for this next round, and what contract is it for? So, like, what fiscal year are we looking at doing a contract for? Vice Chancellor.
Madam Chair, we negotiate just like the state, based on a biennial basis. So when contract negotiations begin with our faculty units, it will be to be effective July 1st, 2025, through the biennium where we currently have the budget request. I forgot the first part of your question. I apologize.
Vice Chancellor, I was just wondering, when do you start your negotiations for the effective date of July 1 of 25?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for repeating that for me. That begins this spring, and I think it becomes more intense once we get into the summer. But I believe those conversations start happening sometime this spring.
Okay. So the conversations begin before we finalize our budget, I guess is the point. So it's always a little confusing. Okay, I think we had another question. Was it Representative Allen?
Yes, Madam Chair. I had a couple questions. Salaries and benefits is about 70% of your expenses. I was just kind of wondering, it's, you know, the devil is always in the details, it seems like. What percentage of that is teachers, which percentage of that, or is the educators, which percentage of that is actual management, and then support staff as far as like janitorial or whatever?
So I represent Ellen, I believe the very next slide will get to some of that, so maybe we'll go through that, and if there's still outstanding questions, we'll circle back to you. Is that all right?
Yep.
Okay. Vice Chancellor Mackey, I think that's your next slide, so we'll let you continue on with your presentation, and thank you for taking these questions now. I know that it's always a frustration of the legislature that you get to negotiate some of your salary, your employee contracts, and not all. And it's a challenge for you. So I just wanted the opportunity to point that out. Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other way that we view our operating expenses, and you know, mentioning that almost 70% is salary and benefits, that's embedded within these functional categories. So when we look at how Minnesota State System spends and allocates its resource, obviously based on our mission, the largest component is for instruction of just over $910 million. The next two high, or the next areas are again relationships that our faculty or our staff have directly in providing instruction or services to our students. So student services at 16% or $358 million. And then academic support is about close to $290 million, the blue portion of the pie in the upper right corner. Institutional support does cover some of the non-academic, non-student services type administration and other fixed costs to run a college or university or a system, and that makes up about $329 million. When we look at, for example, as a system and what our system costs are in relation to other systems across the United States, typically we find that we're in the top 20th percentile of our efficiencies of non-academic expenses towards that. And I know I did not directly address Representative Allen's questions. We can follow up with that. I'm not able, I have a big binder with me with spreadsheets, and I know I have one that has by bargaining unit what our FTE is per unit, so we can provide that based on a position level. Our administrators that are in the administrators plan, that's about, I think, around 4% of our total employees. And then the other 96% are ones that are represented by bargaining units. But we can follow up with precise data. I know we have that.
Representative Allen, do you have any other questions? Or
yes, Madam Chair. The other question I was wondering is relative to other states in the Midwest, where are we in terms of pay with our employees? Are we actually matching with what other state colleges are currently doing? Are we underpaying them, overpaying our employees? Would you happen to know that?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Madam Chair, Representative Allen, I think it would be best if I followed up with the specific information. I know my colleagues at the system office, we do look at national data to see where our four-year faculty stand related to other four-year faculty and the same with two-year faculty. I don't have current data at the tip of my tongue, but we can certainly follow up with that.
Representative Allen, thank you. Okay, please continue.
So now jumping into the various parts of the funding that we received in Chapter 41, the first one is we received $122 million for stabilization funding that was allocated to our colleges and universities. And I'm going to just spend a few moments talking a bit about how that funding is allocated to our colleges and universities. We have a fairly sophisticated and complex allocation model that utilizes a lot of the major components that were mentioned in the previous slide of looking at instructional and academic support costs, student services, facilities, and then also, of course, focusing on one significant portion of our mission, student success. So I know there's a lot of numbers on this slide, but this just illustrates how we allocate funding to our colleges and universities. So this lists 30 institutions on here, 30 rows. The aligned institutions that we have, so you see Anoka-Ramsey, Anoka Tech, Bemidji State University, and Northwest Tech. Our board has had the philosophy that one president, one allocation. So we also have Dakota County and Inver Hills as one allocation. So our 26 colleges and 7 universities are represented by 30 different lines within our allocation model. One of the areas that we focus on, you can see the two main drivers are instruction and academic support. That makes up about 55% of our model. Student services and institutional support makes up 37% of our model. We do look at, for that portion, national benchmark spending data from like institutions to determine an appropriate level of funding for student services and institutional support. We also account for mission differences, that it takes more, there's more infrastructure needed for student services and institutional support at one of our universities than it would be at our college, and that's factored into the model. The other portions of the model, facilities, by definition, that we use square footage of the facilities we have. If a college has multiple campuses, that's factored in, but that makes up about 7% of our allocation process. And then we have some student success outcomes that make up about 1%, and then research and public service makes up a similar percentage. So you can see when we run this allocation framework, pointing to the line at the bottom, it comes to $782.5 million for the system. However, the amount of funding that we have available to allocate as a system in the shaded column, the FY25 base allocation, is $663.1 million. So that's the amount that we allocate. So we don't allocate funding per student to our colleges and universities. Essentially, the way we run this algorithm is each institution comes up with a percent share of whatever available resources we have available. So the column to the right of the shaded column for base allocation, and for sake of ease of reference point, Alexandria, because they're the first alphabetically, their share of the allocation is 1.84%. And that was a 4.3% increase from the previous year. It varies across our system depending on the results of the allocation model. So, for example, for this year, going to the bottom on the total, we had $1 million less to allocate in fiscal 25 than we did in fiscal 24. The stabilization amount was $61.5 million in 24, and it was $60.5 million in 25, and that $60.5 million goes into the model on top of what was previously there. But what you can see from the results in the far right column is that as a system, our funding was essentially flat from year to year, a 0.2% difference or $1 million. But you can see the variation depending on the institution and which direction they may be headed with their enrollment, other efficiencies they might have instructional-wise, that you'll see some have lost funding for this particular year and some have gained funding. So we're shifting funding between colleges and universities based on this allocation methodology that we've had in place since 1999, when after the system was formed. It took a few years to create a model, and then there were some significant revisions that were done that were implemented in 2017 that were about 8 years into implementing. So depending on what your position is within this model, some colleges and universities would say it works well. Others might say it's not fair, and those takes might change from year to year. Also want to, just mention overall to tie how our operating funds flow before I talk about the tuition freeze relief funding that we receive. So this chart, I mentioned appropriation and tuition revenue being our main sources. On the right side of this graphic, our tuition and fee rates go directly to each college and university. So each college and university's tuition revenue fluctuates based on what their own individual enrollment picture is. So the system doesn't do anything related to that. That was one of the principles that the board had when the system was formed, is that there was autonomy related to tuition and fee. Some states do allocate tuition revenue between institutions. We do not. The left side of this graphic shows the various the allocation framework, and that's the $923 million that we have available in state appropriation for fiscal year 25. The two spreadsheets that I just showed you with the $661 million, that's that yellow box, the institutional allocations, but we do have other funding streams that are allocated to our colleges and universities or are held centrally to benefit our colleges and universities because there's some efficiencies and economies of scales we can have doing things as a system versus doing it 30 different ways. So as an example, starting with the priority allocations, that's funding and that was described in the two by the previous presenters, the riders for student support, the workforce development funding, that funding is allocated to college and universities in a different methodology than others, and it's a priority, and that makes up about 6% of our allocation process. The system office has an amount of $36.4 million. That is set as a rider as a specific dollar amount. That's for a lot of the functions that occur at Wells Fargo Place, downtown St. Paul, a lot of the Chancellor's Cabinet and leadership, a lot of the technology that we have, legal services, tax services, a lot of the things that we administer centrally that it would be difficult for our colleges and universities to each do individually. And then we have some set-asides that make up about 6% of our funding, $55 million. And a large portion of that, again, is related to technology. We have about $32 million out of the 55 in that category. We also pay for our debt service out of that set-aside when there's a bonding bill, and we have to pay our portion for projects. That half of that amount, half of the one-third that we're assessed as a system, the campuses pay one-sixth of it out of their budget, and then one-sixth of it is paid centrally out of the system office budget. So, moving into the riders, the tuition freeze relief funding that we received in this biennium, we received $25 million in fiscal 24. So that was in lieu of an undergraduate tuition increase of 3.5%. Then for fiscal year 25, that was in lieu of another tuition increase for the 24-25 academic year of another 3.5%. So the tuition freeze relief was fully funded for 24 and 25. So it was the best of both worlds for Minnesota State. I mean, most importantly for student affordability, that 3.5% increase was not passed on to the students. Mentioned that tuition revenue is a very critical piece of our college and universities operating budget, the second largest source at the universities. It is the largest source. So that funded tuition freeze, the colleges and universities receive that income stream they need to pay for compensation increases, to pay for inflation, while at the same time our students do not have to pay it. I would note that amount, $12.5 million of it was not in the tails for fiscal year 26 and 27. That will, you know, be part of the equation of determining what happens in the future. But that $12.5 million to equate it to a tuition level is about 1.7%. We allocate that tuition funding based on actual enrollment. So it's another methodology that we use. Is we use a two-year lag when we have final enrollment numbers. We take what that tuition increase would have been and what state funding we received in lieu of it, and then we send that to our colleges and universities. So to give an example, you know, one of our largest university, Minnesota State University, Mankato, they would receive the largest amount of tuition relief funding because they have the largest reliance on tuition in the system and they have the largest enrollment, whereas one of our smaller two-year colleges has less of a reliance on tuition and a lower tuition amount being a college than a university, but it's done in a methodology that would be consistent with as if the students were actually directly paying that amount, and we've had that formula in place since tuition freeze funding began back in fiscal year 2014. We also had this biennium some one-time funding of $50 million for our colleges and universities for one-time campus support. We were the legislation directed that we would allocate this amount to our colleges and universities based on their estimated tuition revenue loss due to declines in enrollment that occurred from the last full fiscal year prior to the pandemic, which was 2019. Compared to fiscal year 2023, which was the last completed fiscal year when the 24-25 biennial budget was being developed. One portion of it is that no institution would receive less than $300,000, so we did have some institutions. We had one institution whose enrollment actually grew during that time period, and we had others that their enrollment declined slightly. But in any case, they received a minimum of $300,000, and then we had some that, you know, received a few million dollars depending on their enrollment loss. How this funding was used was in various different ways, and I think I covered this part already. About 60% of it was used to support operations to allow additional time for strategic and financial planning. So there were budget adjustments or reductions that needed to be done at especially a couple universities, and that funding was a buffer to provide a longer runway to plan instead of having to immediately make reductions. Again, we had been reliant on HERF funding during the pandemic, so some of this was to ease us into not having that funding available. Some institutions took that funding and they made one-time investments in some targeted areas. We saw a lot of investments in student success and strategic enrollment initiatives, increased marketing, increased recruitment and retention strategies. We saw some put investments into their facilities, renovate and renovate classrooms make them more modern, set them up for a lot of the hybrid instruction that occurs now, where some students might be participating online and others are in the room. So there were some one-time investments there. Some used it to look at increasing or developing new academic programs. But that $50 million was some valuable bridge funding that was allocated in fiscal years 24. Some institutions decided to spend it over the course of the whole biennium. Others spent it in fiscal year 24. And we reported some of that in an interim hearing, I think in October 2023, of what the plans were and what the value was of that particular funding source. Line 135 of the Chapter 41 spreadsheet is supplemental aid to non-metro campuses. That funding is at $5.7 million, and the rider directs the system of how that funding is to be allocated. So that funding is allocated to the two-year institutions in the system that have at least one campus that is not located in a metropolitan county, and it's at $158,000 per campus. We have been receiving this funding since fiscal year 2018. Initially, it was $3 million per year, and the funding was capped for an individual institution at $300,000, even though there were a couple institutions that had more than three campuses. So there was not only an increase in funding in fiscal 22 is the first year for this, but also an increase in how the funding could be applied to recognize fully the multi-campus institutions that we have across our state. Line 139 of the Chapter 41 spreadsheet was a rider for ISRS, which is our Integrated Student Record System Next Generation Project and System-Wide Technology. This funding was increased by $1.5 million. For fiscal year 24, we had been receiving $8 million. This funding supports our NextGen project, which is the implementation of Workday as our new ERP. It also supports inflationary costs for enterprise technology, which is infrastructure that happens at the system level and supports about 120 IT professionals. In addition, there's also a portion of it that helped fund some inflationary costs with PALS, which is our consortium of library facilities that's run out of the Minnesota State University Mankato campus. And that concludes my portion of the presentation. Before I turn it over to my colleague, Madam Chair, are there any additional questions for me?
Thank you, Vice Chancellor. Any other, so Representative Knorr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is in regards to the user fees. Did we not address that during the last session for capital investment?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, are you referring to the portion that the system pays for debt service?
Representative Knorr.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, I believe there was a bill that was introduced to eliminate the one-third portion of the debt service, but it did not advance. So the current position or current debt obligation that Minnesota State has for projects that's been in place since the late 90s is still the one-third portion of the debt.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to let everybody know that the only institution that pay for a third is the Min State. So it's something that we may want to come and review it again. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr, for pointing that out. I did not know that. Any other questions or comments at this point? Seeing none, introduce yourself to the committee and then continue with the slide presentation.
Madam Chair, my name is Steve Ernest, and my position is Director of Financial Planning and Analysis at the System Office. I'll cover the next three riders. These are all new riders for the 24-25 biennium, so some of this information may be a little bit in the weeds. After these three riders, I'll cover the final slide, which provides a snapshot of the base budget amounts for all of our riders. $809,000 each year for unemployment insurance aid. This funding addresses a change in the unemployment law that allowed non-professional employees who work 9 or 10 months per year to be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits during the summer breaks between terms. The way the funds are to be distributed is specified in statute, the statute you see on the slide there, and is based on the change in total annual unemployment claims each year as compared to the base year of fiscal 22 before the law went into effect. This is a broader level than just looking at the claims for the newly eligible employees. Unemployment is an area where Minnesota State is very decentralized in management because all the names and dates of employment on each quarterly bill have to be verified, and that is best done locally. Working with the Unemployment Office at the Department of Employment and Economic Development, we were able to get a unified report summarizing the bills for all of our colleges and universities to identify the amounts to be distributed. However, some institutions do have more than one account, so they can track different campus funding or different sources like grants. So we recently found out that the report we were using did not pull all the accounts. And as of now, we have identified $465,000 of the $809,000 for the first year that will go up, I assume, when we pull in these accounts that we hadn't pulled in. And then as soon as the final quarter of fiscal 25 quarterly bill comes in the fall, we'll be able to provide the full picture for the biennium for how much of the funding was needed. $861,000 in fiscal 24 and $872,000 in fiscal 25 are provided for costs associated with the increase in the employer contribution for individual retirement plan, IRAP, accounts. IRAP accounts are defined contribution retirement accounts that some Minnesota State employees choose rather than a defined benefit account through the Teachers Retirement Association, TRA. Starting in fiscal 24, the employer contribution rate was increased from 6% to 8.75% of the employee's salary to make the contribution rates the same for both IRAP and TRA accounts. The appropriation is distributed based on the amount each institution pays in employer contributions. For fiscal 24, total employer contributions increased by over $14 million, so this funding was easily used up and covered only about 6% of the year's increased contributions. $482,000 in fiscal 24 and $282,000 in fiscal 25 are appropriated to provide students with access to menstrual products at no charge in all restrooms used by students. A survey was done to confirm the current number of restrooms available to students on our campuses, which totaled over 3,200. Of these, about 30% were signed as male, about 31% signed as female, and about 39% had no gender designation on them. Because the first year's appropriation included funding for hardware, it was decided that the first year's money would be distributed based on square feet of facility space available for students. Overall, the funding has provided has met the needs of students and is sufficient. Although some campuses experienced significant vandalism where dispensers were provided in male-designated restrooms, the student-led initiative was generally well-received. Vandalism has decreased somewhat as more students understand the value of the convenience provided by stocking all restrooms, even if most users at some locations don't need them. So vandalism has not completely gone away. Starting in fiscal 25, the $282,000 is distributed to campuses based on student headcount, since this is more likely to reflect the ongoing restocking needs. This last slide provides a summary of all the operations and maintenance section riders listed by the letter of each paragraph in the funding law, Chapter 41. This shows the annual O&M base going into 24-25 biennium and the annual O&M base coming out of the 24 biennium. So the fiscal 24 column shows base amounts after all the fiscal 23 one-time amounts were removed, but before the new appropriations were added in Chapter 41. So this is not the amount appropriated, it's the base amount starting this biennium. The fiscal 25 column shows the actual appropriation amounts as shown in Chapter 41, and the fiscal 26 column shows the base amounts after all the one-time amounts from fiscal 25 were removed. This is the starting point for this year's budget discussions. The negative numbers in the final column show the one-time amounts that don't continue in the base according to the language in Chapter 41. On the lower right hand, you can see that the annual base funding in fiscal 26 is approximately $49.5 million lower than the amount actually appropriated for the year we are now in, fiscal 25.
Does that conclude your remarks?
That concludes my remarks.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions or comments from members? Okay. We are a minute over, so seeing none, we are going to adjourn, so we have another committee coming in.